Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Let me just say a few words of preface. This lecture is, well, so my parents have been going to Acadia National Park in Maine for about 30 years in a row every summer. And if you've ever been to Acadia, you know it has a lot of small mountains next to the sea that you can climb in a couple of hours, but they're very steep ascents. So, and there are long rocky terrains where you can actually fall quite readily very far if you're not careful. So they put up these handrails that go alongside the mountains, so you can walk up in just like half an hour to a wonderful view. So what I'm going to do is hew quite close to the mountain here, because I'm going to try to talk about Aristotle, Aquinas, Kant, and Nietzsche on the question of metaphysical knowledge. And I have some texts to help guide us and to give kind of, to scale a very high perspective fast and hopefully accurately by staying close to the textual claims of the four authors in question. Some reading I would recommend to go further, and in this domain you can go much further, is Adrian Moore's excellent book from Oxford University Press, The Evolution of Modern Metaphysics, which has a chapter on Kant and a chapter on Nietzsche, each of which is simply wonderful. I think deeply insightful as to what's going on in each of those thinkers in terms of aspirations to realism. And Moore himself, I think, was a Kantian in his demeanor and then has kind of moved away. And so there's an interesting dialogue going on there about skepticism and realism. There's an excellent book, I don't know how you say the Greek name, Vasilis Politis, Aristotle and the Metaphysics from Routledge, which is just a kind of historical analysis. But it analyzes in depth book four of the Metaphysics, which is Aristotle's great engagement with the skeptics, and it's excellent. He looks at contemporary perspectivalism and skepticism, and Aristotle's contentions with perspectivalism and skepticism of his time. And then a more historic book, you might say, about from a not quite 100 years ago, is The Dominican from Rome, from the institution I'm now teaching at, Reginald Garrigou-Lagrange, famous book called In English Reality, in French, Synthèse Thomiste, or something like that, Synthèse de Saint-Thomas-d'Aquin. But anyway, this book, Reality, is found online, but it's his engagement with Kantianism in a modern framework, and there's other texts I give you from Jill Sohn that are apropos. And just to say, I have a book coming out in like about 2 weeks, the last part's the real name of it, On the Reasonableness of Christianity, Principles of Catholic Theology, Book 2, where I go much further into depth on some of the things I'm talking about today and look a little bit at kind of the story of modern materialist naturalism and try to think about why that story might not be a sufficient or complete story for explaining human reality and reality in general. Now, I do teach dogmatic theology principally, which in the Catholic Church is still considered a science and even the chief of sciences, but you make a great deal use of philosophy. So I'm not formally trained in philosophy, but I spent a lot of time with Aquinas philosophically. So that's where I'll concentrate more. And I will, you know, dip my toe in the pond of Kantianism and Nietzsche as a way not really to contest their approaches, but to illustrate the differences. So I want to start with a little, you know, classic story, maybe you know, maybe you don't know, which is that both Plato and a text that would be emblematically the Gorgias and Aristotle, and the text that is emblematic is the Metaphysics, Book 4, both Plato and Aristotle contested with very deep forms of ancient philosophical skepticism and what they would have called at the time sophism, which claimed that there was a great deal of difficulty for the human mind to gain any real purchase on the knowledge of natures or causes in the world, and that linguistic constructions and cultural perspectives effectively determine the content of truth claims rather than, you might say, the content of reality. such that reality would, in the contrasting position, measure our judgments about reality. And both Plato and Aristotle, in two different ways, want to say, no, we come to know reality and it measures our thinking as we get closer to the truth about the content of reality itself. Now, the way Aristotle then tries to work this out is in Book 4 of the Metaphysics, where he takes on the radical skeptical claims of his contemporaries and enumerates a set of principles of knowledge which are antecedent to rational argumentation and demonstration. And the idea here is that to make an argument about what we don't know or do know, you have to already know something. So Aristotle's way, then, is to work from what he calls nous, or the principles of nous. In Greek, that word can mean mind, but it can also kind of mean intellectual insight, to what he then calls, I think in Latin, scientia, but he calls it, it's demonstrative rational argumentation. So his argument is that we get from nous principles of insight from which we can then create episteme, scientific in Greek, or in Latin, the Latins talk about it, scientia, scientific demonstrative reasoning. And his argument with this, the sort of most radical form of skepticism, is that we don't really reason to first principles of certitude, but from them. This is a very, by the way, just to say, I'm not going to pursue this here, but this is a very different line of argument than you find in Descartes' Meditations, where Descartes wants to give, in a way, demonstrations of reason of the first principles of certitude. Okay, but that's kind of another story. The point is, I'm not telling you a story of the kind Descartes is telling. Now, this means that Aristotle needs to tell us about things we already know, and then he needs to argue with the skeptics that though they claim not to have knowledge, they already know the things that these principles deliver knowledge of. In other words, we all already know this stuff I'm about to tell you about. We're not always self-conscious of it. We don't think about it. Children of 5 and 6 and 7 years old who are making use of these noetic principles of understanding are in no way philosophically aware of it, but they are philosophically active in the most embryonic way. They are thinking about being, about reality, even when they're fighting over things in the living room or making claims and demands on their parents' attention. So the point is, there's sort of pre-rational, pre-demonstrative, non-skeptical knowledge of reality. And it's actually only because you have this, you can start to argue about reality. So what I want to do then, and I've kind of summarized my first paragraph there on the handout. The handout will be helpful to you. So the first principle of non-demonstrative, pre-rational understanding is, according to Aristotle, the principle of non-contradiction. And Aquinas follows him in this. So I'm basically, Aquinas wrote a commentary on the Metaphysics. So in Book 4 of the Metaphysics, when Aquinas, in his commentary, which you can find online or buy, he will go through the principle of non-contradiction at great length, and I'm kind of giving you all of this is a kind of Thomistic reading of Aristotle, which is a very defensibly good reading of what Aristotle himself thought, but there are different readings of Aristotle. So the principle of non-contradiction has a kind of ontological form and a semantic form. The ontological form is about the nature of reality, and the semantic form is about the nature of language, and they go together. We speak language, we are linguistic animals, we speak about reality, and in that we can decrypt that we are trying to talk about reality. But so I want to start with the reality talked about and then talk about the talking about reality. So the ontological form of the principle of non-contradiction is said in this way by Aristotle in Book 4, Chapter 3. Evidently then, such a principle is the most certain of all, which principle is that we proceed to say it is that the same attribute cannot at the same time belong and not belong to the same subject in the same respect. That's said very fast. It sounds perhaps a little glib, but the idea is a thing cannot both be and be in the same respect, under the same aspect, at the same time. So I cannot both be in New Haven and in Providence, Rhode Island, right now. Right? That's a very simple application, very commonsensical. We could try to problematize it. If you're a very creative person, you might think about how I could be in Providence right now. But that's by the way, a place and time claim. I'm about to come to the principle of identity and talk about the content. Or, there is an aardvark giving the lecture right now in the classroom, or there is a Homo sapien giving the lecture, right? These things cannot both be true and not true on the same aspect at the same time. That's a nature claim. however we want to worry about what the content of Homo sapien is, it's pretty clearly different than whatever the Latin term is for the aardvark. And, you know, that so we start to then chart out things we want to say. You know, the person in the front of the room talking is dressed in a very peculiar way. There's one other person in the room dressed in a peculiar way, in the same way. You know, and these are not truth claims we can both say and not say at the same time. And this is actually goes under the category that medievals call habit. So, you know, it's like the things you're wearing are things habitual about you. But there are other things habitual, like the capacity to play the violin or whatever. Okay, so then that has semantic consequences. Opposite assertions cannot be true and not true at the same time. So, you know, to say the aardvark is speaking, the human being is speaking, these cannot both be true claims at the same time. Now, this is building simple, but actually these are rather deep claims when you might say, once you start to pull this thread, you can get somewhere very interesting. Because what you're claiming is that to speak at all is to refer to the real in non-contradictory ways. But to speak at all in non-contradictory ways about the real is to attempt to denote things about the ontological content of reality that are complicated. I've already alluded to natures, to qualities, to habits, to space, to time. I didn't even mention quantity. You know, the person speaking at the front of the room is probably not going to be an NBA basketball star. Right, so we could do a whole series of characteristics and talk about how they describe the content of the reality, and that's the way we're kind of linguistically oriented when we start speaking. And then the deeper ontological claim there is, I'm always talking about things that exist. So language is in the field of what's real regarding existence or being. What is it for there to be multiple things that exist? And so now I'm in a really fundamental domain. When I start talking about properties of existence or the content of what it means to say things exist, that enters into everything, even though I also say this existent thing here is not that existent thing there. This human being here is not that human being there, and yet both of them exist. This aardvark here is not that aardvark here. This shade of white is not that shade of white. This 5 foot six person is not that 5'6" six foot person. And so now I'm talking about existences of quantity, qualities, habits, persons, relations. And I'm getting into the problem of the existence and its configurations in reality. So already really at the beginning for Aristotle and Aquinas, as soon as you start talking about semantics, what you're saying when you say anything about the real, and when you start to talk about the diverse things denoted and their properties, and the diverse existences of the things having those different natures and properties, you're already really immediately in the field of the science of metaphysics. That's to say, you're looking at the problem of being. What is it that exists? What are the natures of the things that exist? What are the properties of the things that exist? What are the causes of the things that exist? Now, they move from there, and I gave you a little quote here from Aquinas on the kind of his commentary on the principle of non-contradiction. And by the way, there's a lot of discussion of it in the book. I'm giving you just like, you know, small, you know, kind of pinpoint or postcard version, but it's not a postcard in the discussion of Aristotle. It's quite a long extension discussion. Aquinas comments on it. Now they move from there organically, you might say, to what readers of Aquinas and Aristotle call the principle of identity. So we've got a story going that when we speak, even when, like I say, I don't believe in aardvarks. I don't believe in aardvarks. It's a conspiracy. Well, a better one would be kangaroos, a favorite example of mine. I don't believe in kangaroos. I've never been to Australia. I think it's a conspiracy created to make me believe in a kind of biological diversification in the Southern Hemisphere that's got some shady political rationale. And, I mean, I know there's kangaroo experts out there. That's a cottage industry created by the federal government for funding purposes. No one's looked into this, but it's real. There's a conspiracy about the kangaroo. Okay, so I'm selectively skeptical about the kangaroo. But once I surmount that, but the point is, to be the skeptic about the kangaroo, I already know some things exist. And even if I say I'm skeptical about everything, I mean, I swam in the pond of David Hume, and I drank so deeply I've drowned and I'm never coming up. But I am going to the grocery store. I am buying a carton of milk, and I'm not buying a carton of Coca-Cola because I want to drink the milk. So there's a way in which, once, as Aristotle points out, once you use language, you're kind of in the field of being. And you're kind of inevitably going to at least perform in your practical actions as if you believe there to be existent realities with different natures and properties. That doesn't mean we know what the natures and properties of the kangaroo, the aardvark, the human being are, or whether you and I are very different in being deep down from a brick wall, or whether we're just made of stardust, or whether we're just evolved by accident and chance, all that, those kind of interesting questions. But it means you're at least already in the problem of existence in nature. So then they pass to the problem of categories, of identity. What is the kind of a, where are the joints of reality, to use a kind of a Thanksgiving Day metaphor, if you're trying to carve the turkey up, where are the joints of reality your mind can actually see, okay, this thing is different from that thing. And here they'll articulate what Aristotle called the categorical modes of being, or the categories of being. And I write it out this way. I say the positive corollary of the principle of non-contradiction is the principle of identity. If distinct realities really are not identical with one another, it's because each one has a positive identity in itself, an identity that is determined, there's a typo, that is to say concrete, real, and intelligible. Aquinas follows Aristotle in speaking of the basic categories or categorical modes of being, substance and accidents. Which, if you don't like the word accidents because it sounds weird to you, like a traffic accident, you can say properties. And then I go through the kind of fundamental division of substance and properties. Substances are individual wholes. Like let's go stay with the human being. I give a Petrine example here. It's very catho. But basically, if you take a whole human being like Peter, okay, that there's a certain oneness or unity to him as a human being. And he is an individual having a given nature. So as opposed to say, let's give your kangaroo, this individual kangaroo, a name. I forget the kind of nice Australian names they give them. But anyway, and then, you know, you've got, you know, let's just say, you know, Trisha, the kangaroo. And then the kangaroo has is an individual having a kangaroo nature. Okay, so that's a substance. We use that word substance to say it's a holistic, unified reality having many properties, but that it's somehow one in being, and the oneness of being, you might say, contains the different properties. And then if you start to say, well, what are the chief properties of the human being or the kangaroo, you get into things like quantity. So Peter is 5'10". Qualities: Peter is impetuous, perceptive, and courageous. Real relations: we are, you know, children of a parent or brother or sister of another person. Habits, which are, say, stable dispositions. You're capable of something like fishing or speaking. Actions. So right now, you know, I'm performing an action. But you could have, you could look at someone running, jogging, say what that, you know, that's, it's not essential to the human person that they be jogging, but it is an action they could be actually performing. Passions are things you undergo, like undergoing surgery or undergoing martyrdom, and time and place, like New Haven right now, or position, like standing at the front of class in a certain, you know, internal bodily position or sitting down. You know, these are features of natures. Features of natures. And it's interesting, I mean, there's a lot of literature on this. You know, let's just say, okay, that's nice. There's an ancient listing of the identity of things in themselves, but does that work with modern particle physics? Does that work with modern chemistry in the periodic table? Does that work with modern biology? Well, that's, you know, you have to try that out. You have to get into that. But if you get into like thinking about modern quantifiable micro composite reality and see if the categories help you, you can start to see there are qualities. There's quantity for sure. There's relations and positions of parts. It's interesting to take a chemical or physics or chemistry book and start thinking about whether there are these metaphysical dimensions to microscopic reality, or take, you know, bigger things like read about, you know, astrophysics with stars and think about whether these are helpful categories. And there's a fair amount of philosophy of science being done now on these questions. And then there are features of being, of identity of beings, that are common to all things, that aren't just about quantity or quality or relations or habits or natures, that are individual, like a human nature or a cactus nature or star nature, but are common to everything. And these are called transcendental features of being by the medievals like Aquinas, because they transcend any one categorical mode of being, but they're present, they transcend and are present in every category of being. So that would be things like existence or unity, truth, and goodness, and arguably beauty. So, for example, the quantity of wine on the table exists. The quality of wine on the table exists. The relations of the bottle of wine to other things on the objects on the table exist. And but there also is a certain unity to the quantity of wine, or there's a certain unity to the quality of wine. It's like a consistent quality. And there's a certain goodness to the quantity of wine. That's enough wine. Or no, that's not enough wine. Or there's a goodness to the quality of the wine. That's a lot of wine. It's a good quantity of wine, but a bad quality of wine. Or it's a good quality of wine, but a bad quantity of wine. Right? So goodness is shaped, you might say, in different categorical modes, like existence, like unity. And then there's a truth to all that. Like, is that truly, actually a good quantity of wine, a good quality of wine? What's the truth of the matter? So truth, goodness, unity, being, kind of get into everything. And these are all claims about the actual nature of reality. By the way, I've not made any religious claims. I mean, religious claims can come up when you talk about the author of existence. But really all we're worrying about in this lecture is knowing things truly as they are in themselves and trying to figure out the truth, the goodness, the unity, the being of realities themselves as individuals having given natures with given properties that can be enumerated and studied, whether the microscopic, the middle level, or the macroscopic level. So, you know, we're just talking about kind of fundamental realism. And then you can move from this idea of a principle of identity to the principle of causality. Because the universe we look at isn't just composed of individual aardvarks or kangaroos or human beings or cactuses or stars or cats, or, you know, water molecules or stars or whatever it is, they're all dynamically engaged with one another. And so they're only ever intelligible in some kind of relationality. No one here is interested in long-term oxygen deprivation, right? That we're really conscious that we like living in an oxygen-abundant context. It's not a controversy. You won't find an American campus in where there's a burning controversy about whether we should be living with long-term oxygen deprivation. And at this time of year, you are also especially conscious that we do want to retain a certain kind of proximity to the sun. You know, we're not interested in like a long-term, non-dependence on sunlight and heat. It's not ideal for us, right? So we don't want to get too close either, right? So but that's a causal issue. What kind of causality should sun and sunlight, heat, and oxygen have for the maintenance of healthy biodiversity and bioindividuation among us? Once you start to look at the identity of things and their natures, you start to see that there are relationships between things that are causal. For example, we are allowed to exist or perpetuate because we have adequate environmental resources. So there's famously four causes. Huh? I've been talking more about what you call formal causality, what a thing is in itself. But what Aristotle talks about this more in Metaphysics Book 1, Metaphysics Book 2, so-called Little Alpha, because he has a Book 1 and then there's like a Book 2 that's like a second Introduction to Metaphysics, which may have been a separate text that the librarians added in there. That's highly disputed. But basically, when you start to look at intelligibility in terms of causality, you see formal causality, you see material causality. Everything is made of stuff. So we could talk about, for example, biological organs, their cell composite parts, their chemical composite parts, their atomic composite parts. We know about a lot of that in ways that these fellows did not know about. They work out a theory of elemental material causality that's a little bit different, but they do see that there's material composition in all things. Aquinas has a nice passage from the De Potentia Dei, question 5, article 1, on efficient causality. An effect must needs depend on its cause. This is part of the very nature of cause and effect. It is evidenced in formal and material causes. So just take your kangaroo or your human being who has biological material composition and is formally a given kind of thing, the form being, say, kangaroo or human being. Seeing that on the removal of any of its material or formal principles, a thing at once ceases to exist because such principles enter into its essence. That's why the human being as a composite human being ceases to exist when there's biological death. Even if Aquinas also affirms a spiritual soul that subsists after death, as he does, and argues for philosophically, he believes that the composite human being isn't just a spiritual soul, but also a spiritual soul informing an organic animal body. So there's the whole composite material form substance requires both components for you to be fully human. The statement applies to efficient causes even as to formal and material causes, since the efficient cause produces a thing by inducing the former disposing the matter. Hence a thing depends equally on its efficient cause, its matter and its form, since through the one it depends on the other. So for example, human beings generate human beings, and the sun disposes the matter, because without sun and oxygen, for example, you wouldn't have the capacity to sustain life. As to final causes, the same is said to be of them as of efficient causes, because the end is a cause only for as much as it moves the efficient cause to act, since it comes first not in existence but in the intention. Consequently, there's no action where there's no final cause. That's a strong statement, and it's obviously a hugely controverted statement classically. The idea here is whenever, for example, a nature pursues a certain course of action, he doesn't mean it's like thinking when he talks about intention. He just means it tends towards certain natural realizations that are proper to it. So, for example, a humble example would be water would tend to dissolve stone over a long course of time. Say, a river that breaks down stone because there's dissolvent aspects or effects of water that are stable and enduring properties. So these ends or finalities are generally achieved as effects of water. It's very modest. You get intrinsic or internal teleology when you have living things like bacteria innately or intrinsically orient themselves towards reproduction of like kind. Bacteria produce offspring. And animals not only produce offspring, but they have sensate knowledge that they employ in order to survive and self-protect and reproduce. And human beings seek knowledge, truth, and happiness through free deliberation activity. And then from the idea of mutual causal interactions, interdependencies, you get the principle of sufficient reason, which is where I'm finishing. And that's the idea that it just follows really organically from the principle of causality, which is the idea that when you see the effect of a cause, there's a proportionate origin for it. To take a mundane and yet, maybe imaginative example, the murder mystery. Right? The murder mystery is always the search for the sufficient reason. So we're looking for motives. Murder mysteries, especially the authors like to proliferate potential suspects who have a warranted motive. So, as they always present, they typically present you with someone who might have perform the murder, seems like the easy first solution, and then you actually find out there's 15 different people who might have killed this person, and famously on Murder in the Orient Express, it was a conspiracy of all of them to kill the person, and they all partook of the act with moral intent. So the point is, you try to move from a warranted suspect to finding the actual cause that was proportionate, and you need to look at the murder weapon, the murder effect based on the forensic evidence. Now, say, well, that's just popular entertainment. Yeah, it's popular entertainment that demonstrates the proliferation of common sense, which is that when you have an effect, you try to find the proportionate cause. Modern science just basically lives here. What are the causes of stomach cancer? How do we solve the problem of Alzheimer's? If Alzheimer's caused by X, what kind of medication Y might help us stave it off? All right, so we're looking for proportionate causes of maladies and proportionate causes of remedies. And when we're trying to conduct scientific explanations for micro or macrocosmic events, we're looking for proportionate causality. This idea of a proportionate cause for a particular effect is very old. Plato, I'll give you the references. Plato already talks about it in a certain form. Aristotle talks about it, Aquinas talks about it, and there's different variations of it in modern philosophy. I think it takes a certain different kind of turn in Leibniz, for those of you who are wondering about that, because he's the most famous modern philosophical advocate of it, but I think in a different shape. And Immanuel Kant will take issue with it, which is not something I'll talk about. But I think the basic idea here is that, like, when we look for motives in human action, like, why did he do that? Or why is she upset? Or what's he angry about? Or why are they fighting? You know, we're looking for proportionate reasons. And both those who don't believe in the possibility of miracles and those who do believe in the possibility of miracles make use of the principle equally. Because, for example, if I say, well, with David Hume, you know, people don't rise from the dead, miracles don't happen. What I'm saying is there's a lot of proportionate causes of natural phenomena, and we should stay within that domain of seeing the proportionate effects based on the proportionate causes. We have to explain things by what is predictable according to the order of nature. As where the person who says there are really miracles means there are things that happen that are outside the proportionate framework of natural expectations of what should normally obtain, like blind people don't come to see. So if someone takes their blind daughter to the grave of Thérèse of Lisieux in the early 20th century and prays for the child to receive its sight, and the child receives its sight, that is outside the regular format of proportionate causality, of the principle of proportionate causality, of sufficient reason. So, you know, I think that there's a fair amount of inevitability in human behavior when we start to think about proportionate reasons, of sufficient reasons for how we explain things. So just to recap all that, we started with non-contradiction. We're really already, as soon as we use semantic, signify semantically the nature of reality, we're already sort of looking at the natures and causes and existence of things. When we start to get clearer on that, we're looking at natures of individuals having certain properties. Then we want to figure out what they are. What is the kangaroo? What is the Homo sapien? We have to dig into the matter of the thing, its material composition, its formal frame, that's like its regular activities that denote it. Those activities are typically oriented towards the pursuit of certain ends, like happiness and reasoning about the truth, or like bearing young and caring for them. And then we look at the efficient causes of the thing and the efficient causes of the thing. And now we're starting to get into intelligibility of a web of realities acting on each other, and we see there are sufficient reasons why one proportionate cause creates a certain kind of effect. And now we're in a pretty intelligible perspective about reality, in which there's a field of different existent realities. There's a kind of multiplicity of existences, a multiplicity of natures or essences, and there's a certain unity to each one, a unity of being, a unity of nature, and there's a certain goodness, kinds of goodnesses in things, like moral goodness or biological goodness, or we can talk about a kind of splendor or beauty in things. And we can see a certain kind of truthfulness or intelligibility about things. This is a non-skeptical picture of learning. So now in the latter part of this talk, which I want to say is going to be, you know, maybe 10 or 15 more minutes, I want to just touch upon what I think Immanuel Kant is doing. Now, my aim here is not in any way to, you know, sort of assail the Kantian approach. It's only to kind of suggest what's going on in the Kantian revolution. And then I want to employ a little bit of the Nietzsche to suggest why I think the Kantian revolution is an unstable one. Kant believes he has performed a successfully stable revolution. And I think Nietzsche thinks that Kant has unsuccessfully performed a revolution that can be more deeply radicalized. And so I just want to kind of plant those ideas, which I think more rightly depicts and helpfully so. So as you probably know, Kant didn't write a book of any substantial size till he was in his late 50s, and then he wrote The Critique of Pure Reason, which changed Western society and created kind of modern liberal secular society. So for those of you who are having trouble and you're writing your thesis, you know, like, take heart, you can change the world extremely catastrophically later in life. sorry to all of you who are great lovers of Immanuel Kant. I actually think he's an amazing thinker, so I stand in a pretty great reverence of the man. But as you probably know, he posits that we should undertake, I think I gave you a little quote here, what he calls a Copernican revolution. All the principles I've enumerated to you about categories, about transcendentals, about the principles of identity, the principle of sufficient reason, the principle of causality, he's read all this stuff in Boomgarten and Leibniz, and he knows it goes back. Before that, he hasn't studied carefully Suarez or other scholastics like Aquinas, but he is, in a certain way, was early on to the inheritor of those thinkers. He's got a kind of rationalistic prism through which he's received these classical principles. The revolution is not to do away with the principles, but only to revolve the origin of them and say they're not coming from the outside world where I'm learning about the kangaroo or the stars or the Homo sapien from itself, and so as to know it in itself. I am taking in sensory inputs of the phenomena, and I am constructing an account of the world in what are the categorical and transcendental and principial axioms and concepts of the transcendental subject, that is to say, of the self or of the knower. So all these concepts that I've been talking about, like substances and properties and principle of causality and principle of identity, it's all there in Kant. It's all preserved. But now it's all seen as, you might say, the construct an emergent epistemological apparatus that stems from the transcendental subject as construing the world for her or himself. And the first quote I give you after the transcendental, after the Copernican revolution, is from Critique of Pure Reason 11165, this little sentence. Objects are given to us by means of sensibility, and it alone yields us intuitions. So we intuit through the sensate world, sensate intuitions. He's not yet talking, I think, here about intellect. They are thought through the understanding, and from the understanding arise concepts. But all thought must directly or indirectly, by way of certain characters, relate intimately to intuitions, and therefore with us to sensibility, because in no other way can an object be given to us. So far, this doesn't sound necessarily very different than Aristotle. For Aristotle and Aquinas, you go out, your mind goes out into the senses, you encounter the kangaroos, you encounter the human beings, the stars, the aardvarks, and the cactuses, and you come to know them, study them, and learn through the senses about the being and the nature of things. So you and I come to the real knowledge of each other's natures and characteristics through sensate knowledge. In and through that, the intellect is going into the very being of the thing itself and coming to know it. That's a big, interesting topic in Thomism. How does the mind come to understand the inscape, the inner reality of the other? Which, if that's true, is an amazing feature of human intellect. We go out in through the senses into the other reality and come to know it, which is amazing in its very being and nature. But for Kant, you're in the senses, but what you're doing is you're construing through the sensate information that's coming in your own, you might say, private mental world or personal construction of what the external world is. Now, the happy news, there's good news and bad news. The good news is we're all doing it in the same way for Kant. There's a kind of static uniformity to the constructions that the transcendental subject is bound to consider and formulate. So our, you might say, subjectivity that's constructed about the external reality is going to look very similar in all of us, and that's going to be very helpful for him for ethics, because we're all going to be able to recognize that there's a kind of special feature of dignity and freedom that is in ourselves that we also engage with or somehow relate to in the sensate appearances of the other human being. That is the basis of a liberal constitutional framework for respecting the freedom of each person in the society. But the bad news is, or at least the other important news, is you're not going to get into any big metaphysical projects of understanding natures and existence and causality and being, because that stuff's primarily coming from you as the way you're organizing your sense experiences. It's kind of subjective constructivism. And in this long paragraph here, he says it pretty clearly. This is just one example on substance. I find that at all times, not merely the philosopher, but even the common understanding has presupposed the persistence of the substratum of all change in the appearances, and has also always accepted it as indubitable. Only the philosopher expresses himself somewhat more determinately in saying that in all alterations in the world, The substance remains and only the accents change. This is like you thinking that you're the same being you were when you were 2 years old, or you're the same being you were yesterday, or 5 years ago, or, you know, if you change from not being a piano player to being a piano player, there's this substratum underneath it all that is you in your individual being and nature as a human being who's consistent through time. That's the Aristotelian idea of substance. But I nowhere find the attempt at a proof of this so obviously synthetic proposition. Indeed, it only rarely stands as it deserves to at the head of a pure and completely a priori law of nature. Now notice, he's saying, I want a demonstration that this is real, that there are substances. But what we've been told by Aristotle is you can't demonstrate it. You already know it because you engage it with it in the world, and then you begin to study it, and from the knowledge of substances and their natures, you begin to then make demonstrations. Like, we can argue about whether the human being is only a purely material reality or not. In fact, the proposition that substance persists is tautological, for only this persistence is the ground of our application of the category of substance to appearance. So what he wants to say is that there's a certain sense in which these are the arbitrary impositions or presuppositions that are not necessarily realistic of our human understanding. And I just gave substance because it's a really good central example, but he does this for causality. And then the picture he's going towards in the end, which I'm not going to read, is the famous passage from later, where he basically, I just allude to where it is in the most up-to-date Cambridge, you know, English translation of the Critique of Pure Reason. He posits at the end that because we don't know substances in themselves, because we don't know causes and natures in themselves, and because we don't know the principle of sufficient reason itself as pertaining to realities, we cannot get an account going that would allow us to argue for a transcendent and nonsensible origin of all existence. That is to say, we cannot even really think about God in a coherent way, and certainly can't demonstrate the existence of God in a coherent way, because the whole kind of, you might say, immanent science of metaphysics doesn't give you real purchase on reality from which you could then consequently think about God as the first origin and final horizon of existence. So Kant is pretty careful about this. He wants to say you can't disprove the existence of God by speculative reason. He's in disagreement with some of the more radical Enlightenment atheists about that very strong disagreement. But he also thinks you can't demonstrate the existence of God because you can't get a science of metaphysics up and going. You know, probably that he brings in the postulation of the existence of God as a necessary premise of practical reason, because to pursue justice thoroughly, you have to expect to be disappointed in this world where you don't see justice realized in history in an adequate way. And yet you know in yourself through your conscience you're to pursue just courses of action, so you need to believe in a reward after life or punishment after death of human conduct, which has not proved to be an argument for the existence of God that has held great sway among many people who are inheritors of Kant. He's more well known as the principled agnostic. But the agnosticism isn't, I think, so much about the arguments for the existence of God in Kant as the more fundamental skepticism about the possibility of knowing reality. And I don't want to sound like I'm being flippantly impious or trying not to be interested in God, because I am, but I think there's a lot of this, the importance of this is about something other than God, even, or in a certain way, antecedently, more importantly, which is just the knowledge of ordinary reality and human beings and scientific realism and philosophical and moral realism. Kant is asking us to seed a lot at the beginning regarding common sense realism about what we can know. And I'm not sure it's necessary to do that to achieve the same degree of religious skepticism he wants to at the end. I mean, I'd rather be more an Aristotelian realist up front and then try to generate other reasons to be skeptical about God and not pay so high a price at the beginning in my knowledge about nature and human beings if I were going to try to be an agnostic philosopher. But, of course, taking advice from a Dominican about how to be an agnostic philosopher is probably not very genuine anyway. Now, there have been a number of ways to respond to Kant in the 20th century, and my first book was, which I'm not bragging about in any way, it's not a great book, but it's got a lot of documentation of how Thomists responded to Kant. This is a book called Wisdom in the Face of Modernity, which Mike kindly mentioned. I look at it in a different way a little bit in Principles of, in this book on the reasonableness of Christianity. But it's interesting to go back to Gary Gulagrange and argue that, and who basically presents something like the principles I presented to you and says, the real issue isn't about demonstration. The real issue is about becoming aware of the knowledge you always already had, antecedent to the kinds of arguments philosophers genuinely get into. You might say, to permit the arguments, you need to adequately acknowledge something antecedent, and that's this kind of more fulsome knowledge of being and of natures, which I find a very appealing approach. And Etienne Gilson says something similarly in the mid-20th century, and I have translated it here. We have a concept of being and not of existence or esse. St. Thomas distinguishes between two operations of understanding. The first is that which Aristotle calls the intellection of simple essences. He means you just grasp natures. Even children can tell the difference between the dog and their parents, however vague their conceptual grasp of a human being versus a household animal. The second is that which consists in either a composition or a dissociation of essences in forming propositions. This is judgment, which follows from apprehension. You apprehend the dog, you apprehend your parent, you judge. That's a canine, that's a human being. The second operation, which Aquinas calls compositio, is what we today call judgment. Both of these operations aim towards knowing reality, but they do not equally penetrate it to the same depth. Apprehension attains the essence, which is formulated by a definition, like being a human being or a kangaroo, while judgment attains to the very act of existence. And he quotes Latin, primor operatio recepit quiditatum rei, the quiddity or essence of the thing is attained by the first operation. The second reaches esse, or the act of existence itself. He's saying when you judge the thing in front of you, the person, your friend, your parent, the human being, the canine, the book, the library table, that these things are, that they exist, your intellect can touch through the senses the very singularity of the existence of a given reality. And that radical individual existence is something kind of partly unmasterable, but then you begin to assimilate truth about it, like natures and properties. But you're always rendered relative to the real existence of the thing in front of you, which you're contemplating and learning about. That which is offered to our thought when we say exists is the very act of existence, this absolute actuality that is actual existence. And, you know, Heidegger is influential in Gilson's vision that we need to get back out into, you might say, the savage being of reality, or the unmasterable folds of reality that we don't always already know or construct for ourselves, that we learn about through contemplation and learning through contemplation about the natures and properties of things. I just want to finish with Nietzsche. You know, Nietzsche's very unhappy with Kant because, as he says, it's like a epistemological vestige of Plato. Plato thought there were forms or natures behind the world coming from the mind of the demiurge and the one, and that there was a kind of a essence of human nature that was instantiated in each of us. So the mind is kind of in touch with a higher, with your and my minds, when we think about human nature, is in touch with a higher a wisdom or idea of human nature that comes from God or the gods or the divine. And what Nietzsche is saying is Kant just saves all this by making the demiurge you and I. You know, we're emitting the ideas, the transcendental subjects inevitably emitting ways to construe sense phenomena to stabilize reality. And he's basically saying that Kant's revolution is half-hearted. The Copernican revolution, the turn towards the inner subject as the construer of reality, in Kant is meant to be very radical because it's the overturning of all the classical metaphysics inherited from the scholastics of the High Middle Ages and the Aristotelian science, you might say, the kind of things I've been laying out here. But then Kant thinks it's stable. Between Newton's physics and Kant's interior articulation of the constructions of the transcendental subject, and then the categorical imperative and the role that's playing in ethics, we now have a stable modern system for knowing all we can know and knowing what we can't know and living together with limited horizons of ambition in the order of knowledge that can get rid of a lot of the superstitious dogmas, the theology that's hanging over our heads, get that out. We can take the sciences seriously. We can articulate the framework, or you might say the regulatory norms for an anthropology that permits constitutional civic laicized democracy. But what Nietzsche is going to say is, dear friend, things are less stable than that. After your revolution, yet another revolution is possible, in which we see that actually the transcendental subject is on historical, you might say, tracks. You know, it's moving. You could not only have this first revolution, but then a series of revolutions, a series of metaphysics, a series of kinds of ways of thinking of reality. Each one could construe for himself what he believes to be or wants to be true. And in fact, then we discover metaphysics is actually art. It's the art of the creation of meaning as play. I mean, this is my own kind of Heideggerian reading of Nietzsche, which I think more quite helpfully defends the will to truth or the will to power is the will to art. That human beings create meaning. They're the progenitors of meaning through their own constructivism. And then we could talk about it if you wanted to do it in the more Marxist direction. We could talk about different cultures and times and places, construing a certain kind of normative meaning and imposing it on others. And we could look at knowledge as power. But the other way to do it is in a more individualistic way and say each one has to decide for himself what he or she values and thinks is true in pure productive creativity. And so, I mean, in that sense, Nietzsche wants to say that Kant is in a way like a false coinage of liberation of modernity, because he's like a halfway house between old-fashioned scholastic realism and the attempt to really unmoor humanity from the notions of good and evil and notions of being and truth. And then he's got these delightful passages from the late notebooks, which are recently re-edited by Cambridge, like this last two I'll read. The last thing in metaphysics we'll rid ourselves of is the oldest stock, assuming we can rid ourselves of it, that stock which has embodied itself in language and the grammatical categories and made itself so indispensable that it almost seems we could cease to be able to think if we relinquished it. Now he's talking about the semantics of categories, the principle of identity, and the principle of non-contradiction. He was a classicist. He knows about the sophists, he knows about the Gorgias, and he knows about Aristotle, and he's taking the side of the people Aristotle and Plato were arguing against. Philosophers in particular have the greatest difficulty in freeing themselves from the belief that the basic concepts and categories of reason belong without further ado to the realm of metaphysical certainties. From ancient times, they have believed in reason as a piece of the metaphysical world itself. The oldest belief breaks out in them again and again like an overpowering recoil. He's a man with a prophetic mission to liberate us from metaphysics and from moral ethics once and for all. And then that last wonderful little passage. The inventive force that thought up categories, I mean Aristotle, was working the service of needs, of security, of quick comprehensibility, using signs and sounds of means of abbreviation, substance, subject, object, being, becoming, are not metaphysical truths. It is the powerful who made the names of things law. And among the powerful, it is the greatest artists of abstraction who created the categories. Isn't that lovely? See, he comes full circle. Aristotle's been such a successful artist. You and I have all been hypnotized by his stage show. And we're all dancing in his opera, looking for categories and causes and thinking we're in metaphysical realism. But we can liberate ourselves from that story and each write our own Wagnerian opera. Don't worry, no small countries will be invaded. So, I think that I'm just trying to give you a vignette of three positions. One that is, I think, very classical, I'm obviously deeply sympathetic to, and that I think accords with common sense. But, that you might say that develops organically and reflectively from everyday realism. The native intellectual aspirations of the mind and the inclinations of the aspiration to knowledge and love. The second, which is a more studied critical skepticism, which I didn't do justice to but alluded to, and which I think Kant is worried about transcendental delusions of reason, as he puts them, which about God, the soul, belief in human free will, and the idea of a unified cosmos,
function for him as regulatory notions that may be real, but we can never know or prove or disprove them, are the ambit of our knowledge is much more, the horizon scope of our knowledge is much more limited to the realm of the empirical, the scientifically measurable, and the immediately ethically imperative. And then Nietzsche, who basically finds that too much, too minimal in one way and too much in another way, and wants to really create the idea of, in practical reason, art is everything, and in speculative reason, art is everything. So the artistic intellect is really taking over, as I see it, the kind of the work of what's going on in metaphysics. So, you know, that's just a way of introducing you to a little bit some options that are out there. I didn't mention any of the analytic philosophers, but I think that these books on the board give you some tools to go further in the conversation. I'll end there. Thank you very much, and I'll open the floor for any questions.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.